This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. Congo by Michael Crichton. Copyright 1980 by Michael Crichton. Narrated by Bob Askey. This book contains 343 pages on 7 sides. The Andromeda Strain, The Great Train Robbery, and now Congo. It's Crichton in top form, and the terrain this time is darkest Africa. 3 daring adventurers trek into the jungle, into the very heart of the Congo, through cannibal country, past flaming volcanoes, in search of the diamonds of the lost city of Zinj. Pure H. Rider Haggard, but with the incomparable Crichton difference. His intrepid band, 2 of them PhDs, consists of a young California scientist, specialty primate research, who is accompanied by his sensitive, intelligent, talking gorilla, Amy, a vocabulary of 620 words, a will of her own, and she cries if he leaves her. A geniusy and gorgeous young woman from ERTS, Earth Resources Technology Services, Incorporated, a Houston-based corporation with hush-hush global interests, who is ruthlessly determined to secure the industrial diamonds before her equally ruthless Euro-Japanese rivals beat her to it. A white hunter, whose awesome savvy about the jungle and the competition stems from his deadly experience as a Congo mercenary. The obstacles they must face, pygmies, killer hippos, ferocious tribal warfare, flowing lava, spies from a rival global consortium, and most dangerous of all, a murderous species of jungle gorilla apparently fixated on their destruction, demand from them more than grace under pressure. And they have more. They have all the incredible modern technology Crichton is so brilliant at describing. Laser beams, satellite communications, the most sophisticated computer systems, to say nothing of Amy herself. What happens is a glorious mélange of suspense, excitement, exhilaration, and electronics. This is Michael Crichton doing what he does best, turning a classic genre upside down by introducing and making us understand, while he tells a great story, the miraculous gadgetry and grand designs that dazzle us on the frontiers of science. Michael Crichton was graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, worked briefly in medical research, and after the publication of his first novel, The Andromeda Strain, devoted himself increasingly to writing, 5 novels and 2 works of nonfiction, including 5 Patients. He is also a filmmaker, most recently directing the film version of his own novel, The Great Train Robbery. He was born in 1942 in Chicago and lives in Los Angeles. Congo, Michael Crichton, for Bob Gottlieb. The more experience and insight I obtain into human nature, the more convinced do I become that the greater portion of a man is purely animal. Henry Morton Stanley, 1887. The large male gorilla held my attention. He gave an impression of dignity and restrained power, of absolute certainty in his majestic appearance. I felt a desire to communicate with him. Never before had I had this feeling on meeting an animal. As we watched each other across the valley, I wondered if he recognized the kinship that bound us. George B. Schaller, 1964.
Ship Elliot, how already good. How?
Prologue, The Place of Bones, Side 1. Day 1, Houston, Side 1. Day 2, San Francisco, Side 1. Day 3, Tangier, Side 2. Day 4, Nairobi, Side 3. Day 5, Moruti, Side 3. Day 6, Liko, Side 4. Day 7. Mukane Cove. Side 4. Day 8. Kanyamagufa. Side 5. Day 9. Zinj. Side 5. Day 10. Zinj. Side 5. Day 11. Zinj. Side 6. Day 12. Zinj. Side 6. Day 13. Mukane Cove. Side 6. Epilogue. The Place of Fire. Side 7. References. Side 7. Introduction. Only prejudice and a trick of the Mercator projection prevents us from recognizing the enormity of the African continent. Covering nearly 12 million square miles, Africa is almost as large as North America and Europe combined. It is nearly twice the size of South America. As we mistake its dimensions, we also mistake its essential nature. The Dark Continent is mostly hot desert and open grassy plains. In fact, Africa is called the Dark Continent for one reason only: the vast equatorial rainforests of its central region. This is the drainage basin of the Congo River, and one-tenth of the continent is given over to it. 1.5 million square miles of silent, damp, dark forest. A single uniform geographical feature, nearly half the size of the continental United States. This primeval forest has stood, unchanged and unchallenged, for more than 60 million years. Even today, only 500,000 people inhabit the Congo Basin, and they are mostly clustered in villages along the banks of the slow, muddy rivers that flow through the jungle. The great expanse of the forest remains inviolate, and to this day, thousands of square miles are still unexplored. This is true particularly of the northeastern corner of the Congo Basin, where the rainforest meets the Virunga volcanoes at the edge of the Great Rift Valley. Lacking established trade routes or compelling features of interest, Virunga was never seen by Western eyes until less than 100 years ago. The race to make the most important discovery of the 1980s in the Congo took place during 6 weeks of 1979. This book recounts the 13 days of the last American expedition to the Congo in June 1979, barely 100 years after Henry Morton Stanley first explored the Congo in 1874 to 77. A comparison of the two expeditions reveals much about the changing and unchanging nature of African exploration in the intervening century. Stanley is usually remembered as the newsman who found Livingston in 1871, but his real importance lay in later exploits. Morehead calls him a new kind of man in Africa, a businessman explorer. Stanley was not in Africa to reform the people nor to build an empire, and he was not impelled by any real interest in such matters as anthropology, botany, or geology. To put it bluntly, he was out to make a name for himself. When Stanley set out again from Zanzibar in 1874, he was again handsomely financed by newspapers, and when he emerged from the jungle at the Atlantic Ocean 999 days later, having suffered incredible hardships and the loss of more than two-thirds of his original party, both he and his newspapers had one of the great stories of the century. Stanley had traveled the entire length of the Congo River. But 2 years later, Stanley was back in Africa, under very different circumstances. He traveled under an assumed name. He made diversionary excursions to throw spies off his trail. The few people who knew he was in Africa could only guess that he had in mind some grand commercial scheme. In fact, Stanley was financed by Leopold II of Belgium, who intended to acquire, personally, a large piece of Africa. "It is not a question of Belgian colonies," Leopold wrote Stanley. "It is a question of creating a new state as big as possible. The king, as a private person, wishes to possess properties in Africa. Belgium wants neither a colony nor territories. Mr. Stanley must therefore buy lands or get them conceded to him. This incredible plan was carried out. By 1885, one American said that Leopold possesses the Congo just as Rockefeller possesses Standard Oil. The comparison was apt in more ways than one, for African exploration had become dominated by business. It has remained so to this day. Stanley would have approved the 1979 American expedition, which was conducted in secrecy, with an emphasis on speed. But the differences would have astonished him. When Stanley passed near Virunga in 1875, it had taken him almost a year to get there. The Americans got their expedition on site in just over a week. And Stanley, who traveled with a small army of 400, would have been amazed at an expedition of only 12, and one of them an ape. The territories through which the Americans moved a century later were autonomous political states. The Congo was now Zaire, and the Congo River the Zaire River. In fact, by 1979, the word Congo technically referred only to the drainage basin of the Zaire River, although Congo was still used in geological circles as a matter of familiarity and for its romantic connotations. Despite these differences, the expeditions had remarkably similar outcomes. Like Stanley, the Americans lost two-thirds of their party and emerged from the jungle as desperately as Stanley's men a century before. And like Stanley, they returned with incredible tales of cannibals and pygmies, ruined jungle civilizations, and fabulous lost treasures. I would like to thank R.B. Travis of Earth Resources Technology Services in Houston for permission to use videotaped debriefings, Dr. Karen Ross of ERTS for further background on the expedition, Dr. Peter Elliott of the Department of Zoology, University of California at Berkeley, and the Project Amy staff, including Amy herself, Dr. William Wenz of Kasai Mining and Manufacturing, Zaire, Dr. Smith Jefferson of the Department of Medical Pathology, University of Nairobi, Kenya, and Captain Charles Monroe of Tangier, Morocco. I am further indebted to Mark Warwick of Nairobi for his initial interest in this project, Alan Binks of Nairobi for graciously offering to take me into the Virunga region of Zaire, Joyce Small for arranging my transport, usually at short notice, to obscure parts of the world, and finally, my special thanks to my assistant, Judith Lovejoy, whose untiring efforts through very difficult times were crucial to the completion of this book. M.C. Congo. Prologue, The Place of Bones. Dawn came to the Congo rainforest. The pale sun burned away the morning chill and the clinging damp mist, revealing a gigantic, silent world. Enormous trees with trunks 40 feet in diameter rose 200 feet overhead, where they spread their dense leafy canopy, blotting out the sky and perpetually dripping water to the ground below. Curtains of gray moss and creepers and lianas hung down in a tangle from the trees. Parasitic orchids sprouted from the trunks. At ground level, huge ferns, gleaming with moisture, grew higher than a man's chest and held the low ground fog. Here and there was a spot of color, the red acanthema blossoms, which were deadly poison, and the blue dicindra vine, which only opened in early morning. But the basic impression was of a vast, oversized, gray-green world, an alien place, inhospitable to man. Jan Kruger put aside his rifle and stretched his stiff muscles. Dawn came quickly at the equator. Soon it was quite light, although the mist remained. He glanced at the expedition campsite he had been guarding. 8 bright orange nylon tents, a blue mess tent, a supply tarp lashed over boxed equipment in a vain attempt to keep them dry. He saw the other guard, Misulu, sitting on a rock. Misulu waved sleepily. Nearby was the transmitting equipment, a silver dish antenna, the black transmitter box, the snaking coaxial cables running to the portable video camera mounted on the collapsible tripod. The Americans used this equipment to transmit daily reports by satellite to their home office in Houston. Kruger was the Bwana Mukubwa, hired to take the expedition into the Congo. He had led expeditions before, oil companies, map survey parties, timber mining teams, and geological parties like this one. Companies sending teams into the field wanted someone who knew local customs and local dialects well enough to handle the porters and arrange the travel. Kruger was well suited for this job. He spoke Kiswahili, as well as Bantu, and a little Bagindi, and he had been to the Congo many times, although never to Virunga. Kruger could not imagine why American geologists would want to go to the Virunga region of Zaire, in the northeast corner of the Congo rainforest. Zaire was the richest country in Black Africa in minerals, the world's largest producer of cobalt and industrial diamonds, the seventh largest producer of copper. In addition, there were major deposits of gold, tin, zinc, tungsten, and uranium. But most of the minerals were found in Shaba and Kasai, not in Virunga. Kruger knew better than to ask why the Americans wanted to go to Virunga, and in any case, he had his answer soon enough. Once the expedition passed Lake Kivu and entered the rainforest, the geologists began scouring river and stream beds. Searching placer deposits meant that they were looking for gold or diamonds. It turned out to be diamonds. But not just any diamonds. The geologists were after what they called Type 2B diamonds. Each new sample was immediately submitted to an electrical test. The resulting conversations were beyond Kruger. Talk of dielectric gaps, lattice ions, resistivity. But he gathered that it was the electrical properties of the diamonds that mattered. Certainly the samples were useless as gemstones. Kruger had examined several, and they were all blue from impurities. For 10 days, the expedition had been tracing back placer deposits. This was standard procedure. If you found gold or diamonds in stream beds, you moved upstream toward the presumed erosive source of the minerals. The expedition had moved to higher ground along the western slopes of the Virunga volcanic chain. It was all going routinely until one day around noon when the porters flatly refused to proceed further. This part of Virunga, they said, was called Kanyamagufa, which meant the place of bones. The porters insisted that any men foolish enough to go further would have their bones broken, particularly their skulls. They kept touching their cheekbones and repeating that their skulls would be crushed. The porters were Bantu-speaking Arawanis from the nearest large town, Kisangani. Like most town-dwelling natives, they had all sorts of superstitions about the Congo jungle. Kruger called for the headman. "What tribes are here?" Kruger asked, pointing to the jungle ahead. "No tribes," the headman said. "No tribes at all? Not even Bambuti?" he asked, referring to the nearest group of pygmies. "No men come here," the headman said. "This is Kanyamagufa." "Then what crushes the skulls?" "Dawa," the headman said ominously, using the Bantu term for magical forces. "Strong Dawa here. Men stay away." Kruger sighed. Like many white men, he was thoroughly sick of hearing about Dawa. Dawa was everywhere, in plants and rocks and storms and enemies of all kinds. But the belief in Dawa was prevalent throughout much of Africa and strongly held in the Congo. Kruger had been obliged to waste the rest of the day in tedious negotiation. In the end, he doubled their wages and promised them firearms when they returned to Kisangani, and they agreed to continue on. Kruger considered the incident an irritating native ploy. Porters could generally be counted on to invoke some local superstition to increase their wages once an expedition was deep enough into the field to be dependent on them. He had budgeted for this eventuality, and, having agreed to their demands, he thought no more about it. Even when they came upon several areas littered with shattered fragments of bone, which the porters found frightening, Kruger was not concerned. Upon examination, he found the bones were not human, but rather the small, delicate bones of colobus monkeys, the beautiful, shaggy, black-and-white creatures that lived in the trees overhead. It was true that there were a lot of bones, and Kruger had no idea why they should be shattered, but he had been in Africa a long time, and he had seen many inexplicable things. Nor was he any more impressed with the overgrown fragments of stone that suggested a city had once stood in this area. Kruger had come upon unexplored ruins before, too. In Zimbabwe, in Broken Hill, in Manaliwi, there were the remains of cities and temples that no 20th century scientist had ever seen and studied. He camped the first night near the ruins. The porters were panic-stricken, insisting that the evil forces would attack them during the night. Their fear was caught by the American geologists. To pacify them, Kruger had posted two guards that night, himself and the most trustworthy porter, Misulu. Kruger thought it was all a lot of rot, but it had seemed the politic thing to do. And just as he expected, the night had passed quietly. Around midnight there had been some movement in the bush and some low wheezing sounds, which he took to be a leopard. Big cats often had respiratory trouble, particularly in the jungle. Otherwise it was quiet, and now it was dawn. The night was over. A soft beeping sound drew his attention. Misulu heard it too and glanced questioningly at Kruger. On the transmitting equipment, a red light blinked. Kruger got up and crossed the campsite to the equipment. He knew how to operate it. The Americans had insisted that he learn as an emergency procedure. He crouched over the black transmitter box with its rectangular green LED. He pressed buttons, and the screen printed TXHX, meaning a transmission from Houston. He pressed the response code, and the screen printed CAMLOK, CAMLOK. That meant that Houston was asking for video camera transmission. He glanced over at the camera on its tripod and saw that the red light on the case had blinked on. He pressed the carrier button, and the screen printed SATLOK, SATLOK, which meant that a satellite transmission was being locked in. There would now be a 6-minute delay, the time required to lock the satellite-bounced signal. He'd better go wake Driscoll, the head geologist, he thought. Driscoll would need a few minutes before the transmission came through. Kruger found it amusing the way the Americans always put on a fresh shirt and combed their hair before stepping in front of the camera, just like television reporters. Overhead, the colobus monkeys shrieked and screamed in the trees, shaking the branches. Kruger glanced upward, wondering what had set them going. But it was normal for colobus monkeys to fight in the morning. Something struck him lightly in the chest. At first he thought it was an insect, but glancing down at his khaki shirt, he saw a spot of red, and a fleshy bit of red fruit rolled down his shirt to the muddy ground. The damned monkeys were throwing berries. He bent over to pick it up. And then he realized that it was not a piece of fruit at all. It was a human eyeball, crushed and slippery in his fingers, pinkish-white, with a shred of white optic nerve still attached at the back. He swung his gun around and looked over to where Misulu was sitting on the rock. Misulu was not there. Kruger moved across the campsite. Overhead, the colobus monkeys fell silent. He heard his boots squish in the mud as he moved past the tents of sleeping men. And then he heard the wheezing sound again. It was an odd, soft sound, carried on the swirling morning mist. Kruger wondered if he had been mistaken, if it really was a leopard. And he saw Misulu. Misulu lay on his back, in a kind of halo of blood. His skull had been crushed from the sides, the facial bones shattered, the face narrowed and elongated, the mouth open in an obscene yawn, the one remaining eye wide and bulging. The other eye had exploded outward with the force of the impact. Kruger felt his heart pounding as he bent to examine the body. He wondered what could have caused such an injury. And then he heard the soft wheezing sound again, and this time he felt quite sure it was not a leopard. Then the colobus monkeys began their shrieking, and Kruger leaped to his feet and screamed. Day 1. Houston. June 13, 1979. 1. Ertz, Houston. 10,000 miles away, in the cold, windowless main data room of Earth Resources Technology Services, Incorporated, of Houston, Karen Ross sat hunched over a mug of coffee in front of a computer terminal, reviewing the latest Landsat images from Africa. Ross was the ERTS Congo project supervisor, and as she manipulated the satellite images in artificial contrast colors, blue and purple and green, she glanced at her watch impatiently. She was waiting for the next field transmission from Africa. It was now 10:15 p.m. Houston time, but there was no indication of time or place in the room. Day or night, the main data facility of ERTS remained the same. Beneath banks of special Kalon fluorescent lights, programming crews in sweaters worked at long rows of quietly clicking computer terminals, providing real-time inputs to the field parties that ERTS maintained around the world. This timeless quality was understood to be necessary for the computers, which required a constant temperature of 60 degrees, dedicated electrical lines, special color-corrected lights that did not interfere with circuitry. It was an environment made for machines. The needs of people were secondary. But there was another rationale for the main facility design. ERTS wanted programmers in Houston to identify with the field parties, and if possible, to live on their schedules. Inputting baseball games and other local events was discouraged. There was no clock which showed Houston time, although on the far wall, 8 large digital clocks recorded local time for the various field parties. The clock marked Congo Field Party read 06:15 a.m. when the overhead intercom said, "Dr. Ross, CCR bounce." She left the console after punching in the digital password blocking codes. Every ERTS terminal had a password control, like a combination lock. It was part of an elaborate system to prevent outside sources tapping into their enormous data bank. ERTS dealt in information, and as R.B. Travis, the head of ERTS, was fond of saying, the easiest way to obtain information was to steal it. She crossed the room with long strides. Karen Ross was nearly 6 feet tall, an attractive, though ungainly, girl. Only 24 years old, she was younger than most of the programmers, but despite her youth, she had a self-possession that most people found striking, even a little unsettling. Karen Ross was a genuine mathematical prodigy. At the age of 2, while accompanying her mother to the supermarket, she had worked out in her head whether a 10-ounce can at 19 cents was cheaper than a 1-pound 12-ounce can at 79 cents. At 3, she startled her father by observing that, unlike other numbers, 0 meant different things in different positions. By 8, she had mastered algebra and geometry. By 10, she had taught herself calculus. She entered MIT at 13 and proceeded to make a series of brilliant discoveries in abstract mathematics, culminating in a treatise, Topological Prediction in N-Space, which was useful for decision matrices, critical path analyses, and multidimensional mapping. This interest had brought her to the attention of ERTS, where she was made the youngest field supervisor in the company. Not everyone liked her. The years of isolation, of being the youngest person in the room, had left her aloof and rather distant. One co-worker described her as logical to a fault. Her chilly demeanor had earned her the title Ross Glacier after the Antarctic formation. And her youth still held her back. At least age was Travis's excuse when he refused to let her lead the Congo expedition into the field, even though she had derived all the Congo database and by rights should have been the on-site team leader. "I'm sorry," Travis had said, "but this contract's too big and I just can't let you have it." She had pressed, reminding him of her successes leading teams the year before to Pahang in Zambia. Finally, he had said, "Look, Karen, that site's 10,000 miles away in 4-plus terrain. We need more than a console hot dogger out there." She bridled under the implication that that was all she was, a console hot dogger, fast with the buttons, good at playing with Travis's toys. She wanted to prove herself in a 4-plus field situation, and the next time she was determined to make Travis let her go. Ross pressed the button for the third-floor elevator, marked CX access only. She caught an envious glance from one of the programmers while she waited for the elevator to arrive. Within ERTS, status was not measured by salary, title, the size of one's office, or the other usual corporate indicators of power. Status at ERTS was purely a matter of access to information, and Karen Ross was one of 8 people in the company who had access to the third floor at any time. She stepped onto the third floor elevator, glancing up at the scanner lens mounted over the door. At ERTS, the elevators traveled only one floor, and all were equipped with passive scanners. It was one way that ERTS kept track of the movements of personnel while they were in the building. She said, "Karen Ross," for the voice monitors, and turned in a full circle for the scanners. There was a soft electronic bleep, and the door slid open at the third floor. She emerged into a small square room with a ceiling video monitor and faced the unmarked outer door of the communications control room. She repeated, "Karen Ross," and inserted her electronic identicard in the slot, resting her fingers on the metallic edge of the card so the computer could record galvanic skin potentials. This was a refinement instituted 3 months earlier, after Travis learned that Army experiments with vocal cord surgery had altered voice characteristics precisely enough to false positive voice ident programs. After a cycling pause, the door buzzed open. She went inside. With its red nightlights, communications control was like a soft, warm womb, an impression heightened by the cramped, almost claustrophobic quality of the room, packed with electronic equipment. From floor to ceiling, dozens of video monitors and LEDs flickered and glowed as the technicians spoke in hushed tones, setting dials and twisting knobs. The CCR was the electronic nerve center of ERTS. All communications from field parties around the world were routed through here. Everything in the CCR was recorded, not only incoming data, but room voice responses, so the exact conversation on the night of June 13, 1979, is known. One of the technicians said to her, "We'll have the transponders hooked in a minute. You want coffee?" "No," Ross said. "You want to be out there, right?" "I earned it," she said. She stared at the video screens, at the bewildering display of rotating and shifting forms as the technicians began the litany of locking in the bird bounce, a transmission from satellite in orbit, 320 miles over their heads. Signal key, password mark. Password mark, carrier fix. Carrier fix, we're rolling. She paid hardly any attention to the familiar phrases. She watched as the screens displayed gray fields of crackling static. "Did we open or did they open?" she asked. "We initiated," a technician said. "We had it down on the call sheet to check them at dawn local time, so when they didn't initiate, we did." "I wonder why they didn't initiate," Ross said. "Is something wrong?" "I don't think so. We put out the initiation trigger, and they picked it up and locked in within 15 seconds, all the appropriate codes. Ah, here we go." At 6:22 a.m., Congo time, the transmission came through. There was a final blur of gray static, and then the screens cleared. They were looking at a part of the camp in the Congo, apparently a view from a tripod-mounted video camera. They saw two tents, a low, smoldering fire, the lingering wisps of a foggy dawn. There was no sign of activity, no people. One of the technicians laughed. "We caught them still sleeping. Guess they do need you there." Ross was known for her insistence on formalities. "Lock your remote," she said. The technician punched in the remote override. The field camera, 10,000 miles away, came under their control in Houston. "Pan scan," she said. At the console, the technician used a joystick. They watched as the video images shifted to the left, and they saw more of the camp. The camp was destroyed. Tents crushed and torn. Supply tarp pulled away. Equipment scattered in the mud. One tent burned brightly, sending up clouds of black smoke. They saw several dead bodies. "Jesus," one technician said. "Back scan," Ross said. "Spot resolved with 6-6. On the screens, the camera panned back across the camp. They looked at the jungle. They still saw no sign of life. Down pan, reverse sweep. On screen, the camera panned down to show the silver dish of the portable antenna and the black box of the transmitter. Nearby was another body, one of the geologists, lying on his back. "Jesus, that's Roger!" "Zoom and T-lock," Ross said. On the tape, her voice sounds cool, almost detached. The camera zoomed in on the face. What they saw was grotesque. The head crushed and leaking blood from eyes and nose, mouth gaping toward the sky.
"What did that?"
At that moment, a shadow fell across the dead face on screen. Ross jumped forward, grabbing the joystick and hitting the zoom control. The image widened swiftly. They could see the outline of the shadow now. It was a man, and he was moving.
Somebody's there. Somebody's still alive.
He's limping. Looks wounded. Ross stared at the shadow. It did not look to her like a limping man. Something was wrong. She couldn't put her finger on what it was. He's going to walk in front of the lens, she said. It was almost too much to hope for. What's that audio static? They were hearing an odd sound, like a hissing or a sighing. It's not static, it's in the transmission. Resolve it, Ross said. The technicians punched buttons, altering the audio frequencies, but the sound remained peculiar and indistinct. And then the shadow moved, and the man stepped in front of the lens. Diopter, Ross said, but it was too late. The face had already appeared very near the lens. It was too close to focus without a diopter. They saw a blurred, dark shape, nothing more. Before they could click in the diopter, it was gone. A native? This region of the Congo is uninhabited, Ross said.
Something inhabits it?
Pan scan, Ross said. See if you can get him on screen again. The camera continued to pan. She could imagine it sitting on its tripod in the jungle, motor whirring as the lens head swung around. Then suddenly the image tilted and fell sideways.
He knocked it over.
Damn. The video image crackled, shifting lines of static. It became very difficult to see.
Resolve it! Resolve it!
They had a final glimpse of a large face and a dark hand as the silver dish antenna was smashed. The image from the Congo shrank to a spot and was gone. 2. Interference Signature. During June of 1979, Earth Resources Technology had field teams studying uranium deposits in Bolivia, copper deposits in Pakistan, agricultural field utilization in Kashmir, glacier advance in Iceland, timber resources in Malaysia, and diamond deposits in the Congo. This was not unusual for ERTS. They generally had between 6 and 8 groups in the field at any time. Since their teams were often in hazardous or politically unstable regions, they were vigilant in watching for the first signs of interference signatures. In remote sensing terminology, a signature is the characteristic appearance of an object or geological feature in a photograph or video image. Most interference signatures were political. In 1977, ERTS had airlifted a team out of Borneo during a local communist uprising, and again from Nigeria in 1978 during a military coup. Occasionally, the signatures were geological. They had pulled a team from Guatemala in 1976, after the earthquake there. In the opinion of R.B. Travis, called out of bed in the late hours of June 13, 1979, the videotapes from the Congo were the worst interference signature ever. But the signature origin remained mysterious. All they knew was that the camp had been destroyed in a mere 6 minutes, the time between the signal initiation from Houston and the reception in the Congo. The rapidity was frightening. Travis's first instruction was to figure out what the hell happened out there. A heavy-set man of 48, Travis was accustomed to crises. By training, he was an engineer with a background in satellite construction for RCA and later Rockwell. In his 30s, he had shifted to management, becoming what aerospace engineers called a rain dancer. Companies manufacturing satellites contracted 18 to 24 months in advance for a launch rocket to put the satellite in orbit, and then hoped that the satellite, with its 500,000 working parts, would be ready on the assigned day. If it was not, the only alternative was to pray for bad weather delaying the launch, to dance for rain. Travis had managed to keep a sense of humor after a decade of high-tech problems. His management philosophy was summarized by a large sign mounted behind his desk, which read, SDTAGW. It stood for, Some Damn Thing Always Goes Wrong. But Travis was not amused on the night of June 13th. His entire expedition had been lost. All the ERTS party killed. 8 of his people, and however many local porters were with them. 8 people. The worst disaster in ERTS history. Worse even than Nigeria in 78. Travis felt fatigued, mentally drained, as he thought of all the phone calls ahead of him. Not the calls he would make, but those he would receive. Would so-and-so be back in time for a daughter's graduation? A son's little league playoff?
Those calls would be routed to Travis, and he would have to listen to the bright expectation in the voices, the hopefulness, and his own careful answers. He wasn't sure. He understood the problem. He would do his best, of course, of course. The coming deception exhausted him in advance, because Travis couldn't tell anyone what had happened for at least 2 weeks, perhaps a month. And then he would be making phone calls himself, and visits to the homes, and attending the memorial services where there would be no casket, a deadly blank space, a gap, and the inevitable questions from families and relatives that he couldn't answer while they scrutinized his face, looking for the least muscle twitch or hesitation or sign. What could he tell them? That was his only consolation. Perhaps in a few weeks, Travis could tell them more. One thing was certain. If he were to make the dreadful calls tonight, he could tell the families nothing at all, for Ertz had no idea what had gone wrong. That fact added to Travis's sense of exhaustion. And there were details. Morris, the insurance auditor, came in and said, "What do you want to do about the terms?" Ertz took out term life insurance policies for every expedition member, and also for local porters. African porters received U.S. $15,000 each in insurance, which seemed trivial, until one recognized that African per capita income averaged U.S. $180 per year. But Travis had always argued that local expedition people should share risk benefits, even if it meant paying widowed families a small fortune in their terms, even if it cost Ertz a small fortune for the insurance. "Hold them," Travis said. "Those policies are costing us per day." "Hold them," Travis said. "For how long?"
30 days, Travis said.
30 more days?
"That's right."
"But we know the holders are dead."
Morris could not reconcile himself to the waste of money. His actuarial mind rebelled.
"That's right," Travis said. "But you'd better slip the porters' families some cash to keep them quiet." "Jesus, how much are we talking about?"
$500 each.
"How do we account that?"
"Legal fees," Travis said. "Bury it in legal, local disposition."
"And the American team people that we've lost?"
"They have master charge," Travis said. "Stop worrying." Roberts, the British-born Ertz Presley is on, came into his office. "You want to open this can up?"
"No," Travis said. "I want to kill it."
"For how long?"
30 days.
"Bloody hell, your own staff will leak inside 30 days, Roberts said. "I promise you."
"If they do, you'll squash it," Travis said. "I need another 30 days to make this contract."
"Do we know what happened out there?"
"No," Travis said, "but we will."
"How?"
"From the tapes."
"Those tapes are a mess."
"So far," Travis said, and he called in the specialty teams of console hot doggers. Travis had long since concluded that although Ertz could wake up political advisors around the world, they were most likely to get information in-house. "Everything we know from the Congo field expedition," he said, "is registered on that final videotape. I want a 7-band visual and audio salvage starting right now, because that tape is all we have." The specialty teams went to work.
3. Recovery. Ertz referred to the process as data recovery, or sometimes as data salvage. The terms evoked images of deep-sea operations, and they were oddly appropriate. To recover or salvage data meant that coherent meaning was pulled to the surface from the depths of massive electronic information storage. And like salvage from the sea, it was a slow and delicate process, where a single false step meant the irretrievable loss of the very elements one was trying to bring up. Ertz had whole salvage crews skilled in the art of data recovery. One crew immediately went to work on the audio recovery, another on the visual recovery. But Karen Ross was already engaged in a visual recovery. The procedures she followed were highly sophisticated, and only possible at Ertz. Earth Resources Technology was a relatively new company, formed in 1975 in response to the explosive growth of information on the Earth and its resources. The amount of material handled by Ertz was staggering. Just the Landsat imagery alone amounted to more than 500,000 pictures,
and 16 new images were acquired every hour around the clock. With the addition of conventional and draped aerial photography, infrared photography, and artificial aperture side-looking radar, the total information available to Ertz exceeded 2 million images, with new input on the order of 30 images an hour. All this information had to be cataloged, stored, and made available for instantaneous retrieval. Ertz was like a library which acquired 700 new books a day. It was not surprising that the librarians worked at fever pitch around the clock. Visitors to Ertz never seemed to realize that, even with computers, such data handling capacity would have been impossible 10 years earlier. Nor did visitors understand the basic nature of the Ertz information. They assumed that the pictures on the screens were photographic, although they were not. Photography was a 19th century chemical system for recording information using light-sensitive silver salts. Ertz utilized a 20th century electrical system for recording information, analogous to chemical photographs, but very different. Instead of cameras, Ertz used multispectral scanners. Instead of film, they used CCTs, computer-compatible tapes. In fact, Ertz did not bother with pictures as they were ordinarily understood from old-fashioned photographic technology. Ertz bought data scans, which they converted to data displays as the need arose. Since the Ertz images were just electrical signals recorded on magnetic tape, a great variety of electrical image manipulation was possible. Ertz had 837 computer programs to alter imagery, to enhance it, to eliminate unwanted elements, to bring out details. Ross used 14 programs on the Congo videotape, particularly on the static-filled section in which the hand and face appeared just before the antenna was smashed. First, she carried out what was called a wash cycle, getting rid of the static. She identified the static lines as occurring at specific scan positions and having a specific grayscale value. She instructed the computer to cancel those lines. The resulting image showed blank spaces where the static was removed, so she did fill in the blanks, instructing the computer to introject imagery according to what was around the blank spaces. In this operation, the computer made a logical guess about what was missing. She now had a static-free image, but it was muddy and indistinct, lacking definition. So she did a high-priced spread, intensifying the image by spreading the grayscale values. But for some reason, she also got a phase distortion that she had to cancel, and that released spiking glitches previously suppressed, and to get rid of the glitches, she had to run three other programs. Technical details preoccupied her for an hour, until suddenly the image popped, coming up bright and clean. She caught her breath as she saw it. The screen showed a dark, brooding face with heavy brows, watchful eyes, a flattened nose, prognathous lips. Frozen on the video screen was the face of a male gorilla. Travis came over, shaking his head. "We finished the audio recovery on that hissing noise. The computer confirms it as human breathing with at least four separate origins. But it's damn strange. According to the analysis, the sound is coming from inhalation, not exhalation, the way people usually make sounds." "The computer is wrong," Ross said. "It's not human." She pointed to the screen and the face of the gorilla. Travis showed no surprise. "Artifact," he said. "It's no artifact. You did fill in the blanks and you got an artifact. The tag team's been screwing around to the software lunch again." The tag team, the young software programmers, had the tendency to convert data to play highly sophisticated versions of pinball games. Their games sometimes got subrooted into other programs. Ross herself had complained about it. "But this image is real," she insisted, pointing to the screen. "Look," Travis said. "Last week, Harry did fill in the blanks on the Karakoram Mountains, and he got back a lunar landing game. You're supposed to land next to the McDonald's stand. All very amusing." He walked off. "You'd better meet the others in my office. We're setting advance times to get back in." "I'm leading the next team." Travis shook his head, out of the question. "But what about this?" she said, pointing to the screen. "I'm not buying that image," Travis said. "Gorillas don't behave that way. It's got to be an artifact." He glanced at his watch.
Right now, the only question I have is how fast we can put a team back in the Congo.
4. Return Expedition. Travis had never had any doubts in his mind about going back in. From the first time he saw the videotapes from the Congo, the only question was how best to do it. He called in all the section heads, accounts, diplo, remote, geo, logistics, legal. They were all yawning and rubbing their eyes. Travis began by saying, "I want us back in the Congo in 96 hours. Then he leaned back in his chair and let them tell him why it couldn't be done. There were plenty of reasons. "We can't assemble the air cargo units for shipment in less than 160 hours, Cameron, the logistics man, said. "We can postpone the Himalaya team and use their units," Travis said. "But that's a mountain expedition." "You can modify the units in 9 hours, Travis said. "But we can't get equipment to fly it out," Lewis, the transport master, said. "Korean Airlines has a 747 cargo jet available at SFX. They tell me it can be down here in 9 hours. "They have a plane just sitting there?" Lewis said, incredulous. "I believe," Travis said, "that they had a last-minute cancellation from another customer." Irwin, the accountant, groaned, "What did that cost?" "We can't get visas from the Zaire embassy in Washington in time," Martin, the diplomatic man, said. "And there is serious doubt they'd issue them to us at all. As you know, the first set of Congo visas were based on our mineral exploration rights with the Zaire government and our MER non-exclusive. We were granted permission to go in, and so were the Japanese, the Germans, and the Dutch, who formed a mining consortium. But it's strictly first come, first served. First ore body strike takes the contract. If Zaire finds out that our expedition is in trouble, they'll just cancel us out and let the Euro-Japanese consortium try their luck. There are 300 Japanese trade officials in Kinshasa right now spending yen like water." "I think that's right," Travis said. "If it became known that our expedition is in trouble." "It'll become known the minute we apply for visas." "We won't apply for them. As far as anybody knows," Travis said, "we still have an expedition in Virunga. If we put a second small team into the field fast enough, nobody will ever know that it wasn't the original team."
"But what about the specific personnel visas to cross the borders, the manifests?"
"Details," Travis said. "That's what liquor is for," referring to bribes, which were often liquor. In many parts of the world, expedition teams went in with crates of liquor and boxes of those perennial favorites, transistor radios and Polaroid cameras.
"Details? How are you going to cross the border?"
"We'll need a good man for that. Maybe Monroe."
"Monroe? That's playing rough. The Zaire government hates Monroe."
"He's resourceful, and he knows the area." Martin, the diplomatic expert, cleared his throat and said, "I'm not sure I should be here for this discussion. It looks to me as if you are proposing to enter a sovereign state with an illegal party led by a former Congo mercenary soldier."
"Not at all," Travis said.
"I'm obliged to put a support party into the field to assist my people already there. Happens all the time. I have no reason to think anybody is in trouble. Just a routine support party. I haven't got time to go through official channels. I may not be showing the best judgment in whom I hire, but it's nothing more serious than that." By 11:45 p.m., on the night of June 13th, the main sequencing of the next Earth's expedition had been worked out and confirmed by the computer. A fully loaded 747 could leave Houston at 8 p.m. the following evening, June 14th. The plane could be in Africa on June 15th to pick up Monroe or someone like him. And the full team could be in place in the Congo on June 17th, in 96 hours. From the main data room, Karen Ross could look through the glass walls into Travis's office and see the arguments taking place. In her logical way, she concluded that Travis had cued himself, meaning that he'd had drawn false conclusions from insufficient data and had said QED too soon. Ross felt there was no point in going back into the Congo until they knew what they were up against. She remained at her console, checking the image she had recovered. Ross bought this image, but how could she make Travis buy it? In the highly sophisticated data processing world of Earths, there was a constant danger that extracted information would begin to float, that the images would cut loose from reality, like a ship
cut loose from its moorings. This was true particularly when the database was put through multiple manipulations, when you were rotating 106 pixels in computer-generated hyperspace. So, Ertz evolved other ways to check the validity of images they got back from the computer. Ross ran two check programs against the gorilla image. The first was called APNF, for Animation Predicted Next Frame. It was possible to treat videotape as if it were movie film, a succession of stills. She showed the computer several stills in succession, and then asked it to create the predicted next frame. This PNF was then checked against the actual next frame. She ran 8 PNFs in a row, and they worked. If there was an error in the data handling, it was at least a consistent error. Encouraged, she next ran a fast and dirty three-space. Here, the flat video image was assumed to have certain three-dimensional characteristics based on grayscale patterns. In essence, the computer decided that the shadow of a nose, or a mountain range, meant that the nose, or mountain range, protruded above the surrounding surface. Succeeding images could be checked against these assumptions. As the gorilla moved, the computer verified that the flat image was indeed three-dimensional and coherent. This proved beyond a doubt that the image was real. She went to see Travis. "Let's say I buy this image," Travis said, frowning. "I still don't see why you should take the next expedition in." Ross said, "What did the other team find?" "The other team?" Travis asked innocently. "You gave that tape to another salvage team to confirm my recovery," Ross said. Travis glanced at his watch. "They haven't pulled anything out yet." And he added, "We all know you're fast with the database." Ross smiled. "That's why you need me to take the expedition in," she said. "I know the database, because I generated the database. And if you intend to send another team in right away, before this gorilla thing is solved, the only hope you have is for the team leader to be fast on site with the data. This time you need a console hot dogger in the field, or the next expedition will end up like the last one, because you still don't know what happened to the last expedition." Travis sat behind his desk and stared at her for a long time. She recognized his hesitation as a sign that he was weakening. "And I want to go outside," Ross said. "To an outside expert?" "Yes, somebody on our grant list." "Risky," Travis said. "I hate to involve outside people at this point. You know the consortium is breathing down our necks. You up the leak ratios." "It's important," Ross insisted. Travis sighed. "Okay, if you think it's important." He sighed again. "Just don't delay your team." Ross was already packing up her hard copy. Alone, Travis frowned, turning over his decision in his mind. Even if they ran the next Congo expedition slam-bam, in and out in less than 15 days, their fixed costs would still exceed $300,000. The board was going to scream. Sending an untried 24-year-old kid, a girl, into the field with this kind of responsibility, especially on a project as important as this one, where the stakes were enormous, and where they had already fallen behind on every timeline and cost projection. And Ross was so cold, she was likely to prove a poor field leader, alienating the others in the team. Yet Travis had a hunch about the Ross Glacier. His management philosophy, tempered in his rain-dancing days, was always to give the project to whoever had the most to gain from success or the most to lose from failure. He turned to face his console, mounted beside his desk. "Travis," he said, and the screen glowed. "Psychograph file," he said. The screen showed call prompts. "Ross, Karen," Travis said. The screen flashed, "Thinking a moment." That was the programmed response, which meant that information was being extracted. He waited. Then the psychograph summary printed out across the screen. Every Ertz employee underwent 3 days of intensive psychological testing to determine not only skills, but potential biases. The assessment of Ross would, he felt, be reassuring to the board. "Highly intelligent, logical, flexible, resourceful, data intuitive, thought processes suited to rapidly changing real-time contexts, driven to succeed at defined goals,
capable, sustained mental effort. It looked like the perfect description of the next Congo team leader. He scanned down the screen looking for the negatives. These were less reassuring. Youthful, ruthless, tenuous human rapport, domineering, intellectually arrogant, insensitive, driven to succeed at any cost. And there was a final flopover notation. The very concept of personality flopover had been evolved through Ertz testing. It suggested that any dominant personality trait could be suddenly reversed under stress conditions. Parental personalities could flop over and turn childishly petulant. Hysterical personalities could become icy calm. Or logical personalities could become illogical. Flopover matrix. Dominant, possibly undesirable. Objectivity may be lost once desired goal is perceived close at hand. Desire for success may provoke dangerously illogical responses. Parental figures will be especially denigrated. Subject must be monitored in late-stage goal-oriented procedures. Travis looked at the screen and decided that such a circumstance was highly unlikely in the coming Congo expedition. Karen Ross was exhilarated by her new authority. Shortly before midnight, she called up the grant lists on her office terminal. Ertz had animal experts in various areas whom they supported with nominal grants from a non-profit foundation called the Earth Resources Wildlife Fund. The grant lists were arranged taxonomically. Under primates, she found 14 names, including several in Borneo, Malaysia, and Africa, as well as the United States. In the United States, there was only one gorilla researcher available, a primatologist named Dr. Peter Elliott at the University of California at Berkeley. The file on screen indicated that Elliott was 29 years old, unmarried, an associate professor without tenure in the Department of Zoology. Principal research interest was listed as primate communications, gorilla. Funding was made to something called Project Amy. She checked her watch. It was just midnight in Houston, 10 p.m. in California. She dialed the home number on the screen. "Hello?" a weary male voice said. "Dr. Peter Elliott?" "Yes." The voice was still cautious, hesitant. "Are you a reporter?" "No," she said. "This is Dr. Karen Ross in Houston. I'm associated with the Earth Resources Wildlife Fund, which supports your research." "Oh, yes." The voice remained cautious. "You're sure you're not a reporter? It's only fair to tell you I'm recording this telephone call as a potential legal document." Karen Ross hesitated. The last thing she needed was some paranoid academic recording Ertz developments. She said nothing. "You're American?" he said. "Of course." Karen Ross stared at the computer screens, which flashed, "Voice identification confirmed, Elliott, Peter, 29 years. "State your business," Elliott said. "Well, we're about to send an expedition into the Virunga region of the Congo, and..." "Really? When are you going?" The voice suddenly sounded excited, boyish. "Well, as a matter of fact, we're leaving in 2 days, and..." "I want to go," Elliott said. Ross was so surprised she hardly knew what to say. "Well, Dr. Elliott, that's not why I'm calling you, as a matter of fact." "I'm planning to go there anyway," Elliott said, "with Amy." "Who's Amy?" "Amy is a gorilla," Peter Elliott said. Day 2, San Francisco, June 14th, 1979. 1. Project Amy. It is unfair to suggest, as some primatologists later did, that Peter Elliott had to get out of town in June 1979. His motives and the planning behind the decision to go to the Congo are a matter of record. Professor Elliott and his staff had decided on an African trip at least 2 days before Ross called him. But it is certainly true that Peter Elliott was under attack from outside groups, the press, academic colleagues, and even members of his own department at Berkeley. Toward the end, Elliott was accused of being a Nazi criminal engaged in the torture of dumb, sick animals. It is no exaggeration to say that Elliott had found himself in the spring of 1979, fighting for his professional life. Yet his research had begun quietly, almost accidentally. Peter Elliott was a 23-year-old graduate student in the Department of Anthropology at Berkeley when he first read about a year-old gorilla with amoebic dysentery who had been flown from the Minneapolis Zoo to the San Francisco School of Veterinary Medicine for treatment. That was in 1973, in the exciting early days of primate language research. The idea that primates might be taught language was very old. In 1661, Samuel Pepys saw a chimpanzee in London and wrote in his diary that it was so much like a man in most things that I do believe that it already understands much English, and I am of the mind it might be taught to speak or make signs. Another 17th century writer went further, saying, apes and baboons can speak but will not, for fear they should be employed and set to work. Yet for the next 300 years, attempts to teach apes to talk were notably unsuccessful. They culminated in an ambitious effort by a Florida couple, Keith and Kathy Hayes, who for 6 years in the early 1950s raised a chimpanzee named Vicky as if she were a human infant. During that time, Vicky learned 4 words, mama, papa, cup, and up. But her pronunciation was labored, and her progress slow. Her difficulties seemed to support the growing conviction among scientists that man was the only animal capable of language. Typical was the pronouncement of George Gaylord Simpson, "Language is the most diagnostic single trait of man. All normal men have language. No other now living organisms do." This seemed so self-evident that for the next 15 years, nobody bothered to try teaching language to an ape. Then in 1966, a Reno, Nevada couple named Beatrice and Alan Gardner reviewed movies of Vicky speaking. It seemed to them that Vicky was not so much incapable of language as incapable of speech. They noticed that while her lip movements were awkward, her hand gestures were fluid and expressive. The obvious conclusion was to try sign language. In June 1966, the Gardners began teaching American Sign Language, AMISLAN, the standardized language of the deaf, to an infant chimpanzee named Washo. Washo's progress with ASL was rapid. By 1971, she had a vocabulary of 160 signs, which she used in conversation. She also made up new word combinations for things she had never seen before. When shown watermelon for the first time, she signed it water fruit. The Gardner's work was highly controversial. It turned out that many scientists had an investment in the idea that apes were incapable of language. As one researcher said, "My God, think of all those eminent names attached to all those scholarly papers for all those decades, and everyone agreeing that only man had language. What a mess." Washoe's skills provoked a variety of other experiments in teaching language. A chimpanzee named Lucy was taught to communicate through a computer. Another, Sarah, was taught to use plastic markers on a board. Other apes were studied as well. An orangutan named Alfred began instruction in 1971. A lowland gorilla named Coco in 1972. And in 1973, Peter Elliott began with a mountain gorilla, Amy. At his first visit to the hospital to meet Amy, he found a pathetic little creature, heavily sedated, with restraining straps on her frail black arms and legs. He stroked her head and said gently, "Hello, Amy. I'm Peter." Amy promptly bit his hand, drawing blood. From this inauspicious beginning emerged a singularly successful research program. In 1973, the basic teaching technique called molding was well understood. The animal was shown an object, and the researcher simultaneously molded the animal's hand into the correct sign until the association was firmly made. Subsequent testing confirmed that the animal understood the meaning of the sign. But if the basic methodology was accepted, the application was highly competitive. Researchers competed over the rate of sign acquisition or vocabulary. Among human beings, vocabulary was considered the best measure of intelligence. The rate of sign acquisition could be taken as a measure of either the scientist's skill or the animal's intelligence. It was by now clearly recognized that different apes had different personalities. As one researcher commented, Pongid studies are perhaps the only field in which academic gossip centers on the students and not the teachers. In the increasingly competitive and disputatious world of primate research, it was said that Lucy was a drunk, that Coco was an ill-mannered brat, that Lana's head was turned by her celebrity, she only works when there is an interviewer present, and that Nim was so stupid he should have been named Dim. At first glance, it may seem odd that Peter Elliot should have come under attack, for this handsome, rather shy man, the son of a Marin County dry cleaner, had avoided controversy during his years of work with Amy. Elliot's publications were modest and temperate. His progress with Amy was well documented. He showed no interest in publicity, and was not among those researchers who took their apes on the Carson or the Griffin show. But Elliot's diffident manner concealed not only a quick intelligence, but a fierce ambition as well. If he avoided controversy, it was only because he didn't have time for it. He had been working nights and weekends for years and driving his staff and Amy just as hard. He was very good at the business of science, getting grants. At all the animal behaviorist conferences, where others showed up in jeans and plaid lumberjack shirts, Elliot arrived in a three-piece suit. Elliot intended to be the foremost ape researcher, and he intended Amy to be the foremost ape. Elliot's success in obtaining grants was such that by 1975 he employed four people working full-time with Amy. By 1978, Project Amy had an annual budget of $160,000 and a staff of eight, including a child psychologist and a computer programmer. A staff member of the Berggren Institute later said that Elliot's appeal lay in the fact that he was a good investment. For example, Project Amy got 50% more computer time for our money because he went online with his time-sharing terminal at night and on weekends when the time was cheaper. He was very cost-effective and dedicated, of course. Elliot obviously cared about nothing in life except his work with Amy. That made him a boring conversationalist, but a very good bet from our standpoint. It's hard to decide who's truly brilliant. It's easier to see who's driven, which in the long run may be more important. We anticipated great things from Elliot. Peter Elliot's difficulties began on the morning of February 2nd, 1979. Amy lived in a mobile home on the Berkeley campus. She spent nights there alone and usually provided an effusive greeting the next day. However, on that morning, the Project Amy staff found her in an uncharacteristic sullen mood. She was irritable and bleary-eyed, behaving as if she had been wronged in some fashion. Elliot felt that something had upset her during the night. When asked, she kept making signs for sleep box, a new word pairing he did not understand. That in itself was not unusual. Amy made up new word pairings all the time, and they were often hard to decipher. Just a few days before, she had bewildered them by talking about crocodile milk. Eventually, they realized that Amy's milk had gone sour, and that since she disliked crocodiles, which she had only seen in picture books, she somehow decided that sour milk was crocodile milk. Now she was talking about sleep box. At first, they thought she might be referring to her nest-like bed. It turned out she was using box in her usual sense to refer to the television set. Everything in her trailer, including the television, was controlled on a 24-hour cycle by the computer. They ran a check to see if the television had been turned on during the night, disturbing her sleep. Since Amy liked to watch television, it was conceivable that she had managed to turn it on herself. But Amy looked scornful as they examined the actual television in the trailer. She clearly meant something else. Finally, they determined that by sleep box, she meant sleep pictures. When asked about these sleep pictures, Amy signed that they were bad pictures and old pictures, and that they make Amy cry. She was dreaming. The fact that Amy was the first primate to report dreams caused tremendous excitement among Elliot's staff. But the excitement was short-lived. Although Amy continued to dream on succeeding nights, she refused to discuss her dreams. In fact, she seemed to blame the researchers for this new and confusing intrusion into her mental life. Worse, her waking behavior deteriorated alarmingly. Her word acquisition rate fell from 2.7 words a week to 0.8 words a week. Her spontaneous word formation rate from 1.9 to 0.3. Monitored attention span was halved. Mood swings increased. Erratic and unmotivated behavior became commonplace. Temper tantrums occurred daily. Amy was 4.5 feet tall and weighed 130 pounds. She was an immensely strong animal. The staff began to wonder if they could control her. Her refusal to talk about her dreams frustrated them. They tried a variety of investigative approaches. They showed her pictures from books and magazines. They ran the ceiling-mounted video monitors around the clock in case she signed something significant while alone. Like young children, Amy often talked to herself. They even administered a battery of neurological tests, including an EEG. Finally, they hit on finger painting. This was immediately successful. Amy was enthusiastic about finger painting, and after they mixed cayenne pepper with the pigments, she stopped licking her fingers. She drew images swiftly and repetitively, and she seemed to become somewhat more relaxed, more her old self. David Bergman, the child psychologist, noted that what Amy actually draws is a cluster of apparently related images, inverted crescent shapes or semicircles, which are always associated with an area of vertical green streaks. Amy says the green streaks represent forest, and she calls the semicircles bad houses or old houses. In addition, she often draws black circles, which she calls holes. Bergman cautioned against the obvious conclusion that she was drawing old buildings in the jungle. Watching her make drawings one after another, again and again, convinces me of the obsessive and private nature of the imagery. Amy is troubled by these pictures, and she is trying to get them out, to banish them to paper. In fact, the nature of the imagery remained mysterious to the Project Amy staff. By late April 1979, they had concluded that her dreams could be explained in four ways. In order of seriousness, they were: 1. The dreams are an attempt to rationalize events in her daily life. This was the usual explanation of human dreams, but the staff doubted that it applied in Amy's case. 2. The dreams are a transitional adolescent manifestation. At 7 years of age, Amy was a guerrilla teenager, and for nearly a year she had shown many typical teenage traits, including rages and sulks, fussiness about her appearance, a new interest in the opposite sex. 3. The dreams are a species-specific phenomenon. It was possible that all gorillas had disturbing dreams, and that in the wild the resultant stresses were handled in some fashion by the behavior of the group. Although gorillas had been studied in the wild for the past 20 years, there was no evidence for this. 4. The dreams are the first sign of incipient dementia. This was the most feared possibility. To train an ape effectively, one had to begin with an infant. As the years progressed, researchers waited to see if their animal would grow up to be bright or stupid, recalcitrant or pliable, healthy or sickly. The health of apes was a constant worry. Many programs collapsed after years of effort and expense when the apes died of physical or mental illness. Timothy, an Atlanta chimp, became psychotic in 1976 and committed suicide by coprophagia, choking to death on his own feces. Maurice, a Chicago orang, became intensely neurotic, developing phobias that halted work in 1977. For better or worse, the very intelligence that made apes worthwhile subjects for study also made them as unstable as human beings. But the Project Amy staff was unable to make further progress. In May 1979, they made what turned out to be a momentous decision. They decided to publish Amy's drawings and submitted her images to the Journal of Behavioral Sciences. 2. Breakthrough. Dream Behavior in a Mountain Gorilla was never published. The paper was routinely forwarded to 3 scientists on the editorial board for review, and one copy, somehow, it is still unclear just how, fell into the hands of the Primate Preservation Agency, a New York group formed in 1975 to prevent the unwarranted and illegitimate exploitation of intelligent primates in unnecessary laboratory research. Footnote: the following account of Eliot's persecution draws heavily on J. A. Peebles' Infringement of Academic Freedom by Press Innuendo and Hearsay, The Experience of Dr. Peter Eliot, in the Journal of Academic Law and Psychiatry, 52, No. 12, 1979, 19-38. Text continues. On June 3rd, the PPA began picketing the zoology department at Berkeley and calling for the release of Amy. Most of the demonstrators were women, and several young children were present. Videotapes of an 8-year-old boy holding a placard with Amy's photograph and shouting, "Free Amy, Free Amy," appeared on local television news. In a tactical error, the Project Amy staff elected to ignore the protests, except for a brief press release stating that the PPA was misinformed. The release went out under the Berkeley Information Office letterhead. On June 5th, the PPA released comments on Professor Elliott's work from other primatologists around the country. Many later denied the comments or claimed they were misquoted. Dr. Wayne Terman of the University of Oklahoma at Norman was quoted as saying that Elliott's work was fanciful and unethical. Dr. Felicity Hammond of the Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta said that neither Elliott nor his research is of the first rank. Dr. Richard Aronson at the University of Chicago called the research clearly fascist in nature. None of these scientists had read Elliott's paper before commenting, but the damage, particularly from Aronson, was incalculable. On June 8th, Eleanor Vries, the spokesperson for the PPA, referred to the criminal research of Dr. Elliott and his Nazi staff. She claimed Elliott's research caused Amy to have nightmares, and that Amy was being subjected to torture, drugs, and electroshock treatments. Belatedly, on June 10th, the Project Amy staff prepared a lengthy press release, explaining their position in detail and referring to the unpublished paper. But the University Information Office was now too busy to issue the release. On June 11th, the Berkeley faculty scheduled a meeting to consider issues of ethical conduct within the university. Eleanor Vries announced that the PPA had hired the noted San Francisco attorney, Melvin Belli, to free Amy from subjugation. Belli's office was not available for comment. On the same day, the Project Amy staff had a sudden, unexpected breakthrough in their understanding of Amy's dreams. Through all the publicity and commotion, the group had continued to work daily with Amy, and her continued distress and flaring temper tantrums was a constant reminder that they had not solved the initial problem. They persisted in their search for clues, although when the break finally came, it happened almost by accident. Sarah Johnson, a research assistant, was checking prehistoric archaeological sites in the Congo on the unlikely chance that Amy might have seen such a site, old buildings in the jungle, in her infancy, before she was brought to the Minneapolis Zoo. Johnson quickly discovered the pertinent facts about the Congo. The region had not been explored by Western observers until 100 years ago. In recent times, hostile tribes and civil war had made scientific inquiry hazardous, and finally, the moist jungle environment did not lend itself to artifact preservation. This meant remarkably little was known about Congolese prehistory, and Johnson completed her research in a few hours. But she was reluctant to return so quickly from her assignment, so she stayed on, looking at other books in the anthropology library, ethnographies, histories, early accounts. The earliest visitors to the interior of the Congo were Arab slave traders and Portuguese merchants, and several had written accounts of their travels. Because Johnson could read neither Arabic nor Portuguese, she just looked at the plates, and then she saw a picture that, she said, sent a chill up my spine. It was a Portuguese engraving, originally dated 1642, and reprinted in an 1842 volume. The ink was yellowing on frayed, brittle paper, but clearly visible was a ruined city in the jungle, overgrown with creeper vines and giant ferns. The doors and windows were constructed with semicircular arches, exactly as Amy had drawn them. It was, Elliot said later, the kind of opportunity that comes to a researcher once in his lifetime, if he's lucky. Of course, we knew nothing about the picture. The caption was written in flowing script and included a word that looked like zinj, and the date, 1642. We immediately hired translators skilled in archaic Arabic and 17th century Portuguese, but that wasn't the point. The point was, we had a chance to verify a major theoretical question. Amy's pictures seemed to be a clear case of specific genetic memory. Genetic memory was first proposed by Marais in 1911, and it had been vigorously debated ever since. In its simplest form, the theory proposed that the mechanism of genetic inheritance, which governed the transmission of all physical traits, was not limited to physical traits alone. Behavior was clearly genetically determined in lower animals, which were born with complex behavior that did not have to be learned. But higher animals had more flexible behavior dependent on learning and memory. The question was whether higher animals, particularly apes and men, had any part of their psychic apparatus fixed from birth by their genes. Now, Elliot felt, with Amy they had evidence for such a memory. Amy had been taken from Africa when she was only 7 months old. Unless she had seen this ruined city in her infancy, her dreams represented a specific genetic memory which could be verified by a trip to Africa. By the evening of June 11th, the Project Amy staff was agreed, if they could arrange it and pay for it, they would take Amy back to Africa. On June 12th, the team waited for the translators to complete work on the source material. Checked translations were expected to be ready within 2 days, but a trip to Africa for Amy and two staff members would cost at least $30,000, a substantial fraction of their total annual operating budget. And transporting a gorilla halfway around the world involved a bewildering tangle of customs regulations and bureaucratic red tape. Clearly, they needed expert help, but they were not sure where to turn. And then, on June 13th, Dr. Karen Ross from one of their granting institutions, the Earth Resources Wildlife Fund, called from Houston to say that she was leading an expedition into the Congo in 2 days' time. And although she showed no interest in taking Peter Elliott or Amy with her, she conveyed, at least over the telephone, a confident familiarity with the way expeditions were assembled and managed in far-off places around the world. When she asked if she could come to San Francisco to meet with Dr. Elliott, Dr. Elliott replied that he would be delighted to meet with her at her convenience. 3. Legal issues. Peter Elliott remembered June 14, 1979, as a day of sudden reverses. He began at 8 a.m. in the San Francisco law firm of Sutherland, Morton & O'Connell because of the threatened custody suit from the PPA, a suit which became all the more important now that he was planning to take Amy out of the country. He met with John Morton in the firm's wood-paneled library overlooking Grant Street. Morton took notes on a yellow legal pad. "I think you're all right," Morton began, "but let me get a few facts. Amy is a gorilla?" "Yes, a female mountain gorilla." "Age?" "She's 7 now." "So she's still a child?" Elliot explained that gorillas matured in 6 to 8 years, so that Amy was late adolescent, the equivalent of a 16-year-old human female. Morton scratched notes on a pad. "Could we say she's still a minor?" "Do we want to say that?" "I think so." "Yes, she's still a minor," Elliot said. "Where did you come from? I mean, originally?" "A woman tourist named Swenson found her in Africa, in a village called Bagamindi. Amy's mother had been killed by the natives for food. Mrs. Swenson bought her as an infant." "So she was not bred in captivity," Morton said, writing on his pad. "No, Mrs. Swenson brought her back to the States and donated her to the Minneapolis Zoo." "She relinquished her interest in Amy?" "I assume so," Elliot said. "We've been trying to reach Mrs. Swenson to ask about Amy's early life, but she's out of the country. Apparently she travels constantly. She's in Borneo. Anyway, when Amy was sent to San Francisco, I called the Minneapolis Zoo to ask if I could keep her for study. The zoo said yes, for 3 years. End of side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.